Fran fam, what's going on? Listen, before we start this podcast episode, I have a very, very small favor to ask of each and every single one of you guys. I appreciate the support that all of you have been showing for the podcast up until this point, but we want to try and get these episodes out to as many people as possible. And how we do that on the audio side is by leaving a review and dropping a 5-star rating. So if you've been a consistent listener of the pod, please, before we get this episode started, it only takes a couple of seconds, leave a review. It could be a 2-word, 3-word, 4-word review, or just leave a rating. Do something to get the word out so that we can get the Marvin Francois Show to more listeners moving forward. Outside of that, love you guys, appreciate the support, but without further ado, let's get into this episode.
In our community, when people are on their build, instead of like leaning into what they're doing well already, they're like, oh, I'm gonna start another business. Versus being like, okay, I do this really well. How can I build this business? How can I double this business this year? How can I build more strategic relationships and that kind of stuff?
Imagine making the next big investment in your business without worrying about how you secure the capital to do it. Every day you're putting in the work. You clock in at your job, you stay up late to work on your business, you handle your family responsibilities, but hard work isn't enough to create financial freedom. Here's why so many entrepreneurs still feel stuck. Business credit approvals keep slipping through your fingers. The advice that you've been given doesn't match the results. And you've invested in yourself, but without having the right structure, it hasn't paid off. It's not that you're not capable, it's just that the path that you've been given is broken. That's why I created the Fast Track to Capital. It's a proven framework that entrepreneurs are using to boost their credit so that lenders can trust them, structure their business so that banks see them as credible, and access $50,000 to $100,000 in business credit so they can finally act on opportunities. This isn't about working harder. It's about applying the same structure that wealthy entrepreneurs have been using for years. So if you're ready to stop spinning your wheels and actually move forward, click the link above or below this video to secure your spot in the free masterclass, and I'll see you on the other side of success. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Marvin Francois Show, your number one source for all things business, finance, and investing. And today, is a very special day because our guest today is an Olympian, attorney, investor, entrepreneur, keynote speaker, and wealth preservation strategist extraordinaire. She's a former track and field star turned securities attorney who now helps high net worth families and wealthy entrepreneurs protect, grow, and transfer assets through trusts, privacy structures, and strategic acquisitions. From hurdling on the world's biggest stage in the Olympics to overseeing multi-million dollar asset plans as a lawyer, her journey is a masterclass in passion, persistence, and purpose personified. And whether she's speaking on stage in front of thousands or providing free value on podcasts just like this, her mission remains the same: to bridge the gap between elite financial tools and the communities that need them most, teaching us why acquiring assets and protecting them isn't just a hot topic for social media, it's the ultimate wealth preservation strategy. And today, she's here to do more of the same. Ladies and gentlemen, from Hampton, Virginia, by way of Hollywood, Florida, I'm here with the one, the only, Mrs. Lala Idelet. What's going on, family? How are you?
If you want to travel with me to give that introduction Come on. I am willing to have it.
I got
you. Thank you so much for having me.
Man, listen, thank you for being a part of the show. I'm excited for this conversation. How are you?
I am phenomenal.
Good, good. Excited for this conversation. I have been following you for some time. We talked about it off air, but man, you have been on quite a few podcasts providing a lot of value that our people need. And I'm looking forward to a conversation that will be somewhat similar, probably, hopefully even better. We'll see. 100%. So I know who you are. I know there are some people who are watching right now who may be unfamiliar. So let's get them familiar. Who exactly is Lala Idelet?
Man, so I am a lady.
Okay.
So I am from Hampton, Virginia. I did go to the Olympics. I am a mother. I am a wife. I run a few businesses and I take care of families so that they can, you know, leave the legacy they want to leave.
Beautifully said. Let's go back, obviously, because I'm sure your path to getting to this point wasn't super linear. Like you said, I mean, at one point in time, you were a track and field star. Now, the work that you're doing in your space is incredible. Let's kind of connect the dots, if you will. Before we got to this point and you accomplished the success that you have now, what were some of your earliest memories of what life looked like for you as an adolescent? Let's go back to around that time.
Ooh, okay. So I was rough.
Okay.
I grew up in Hampton, Virginia. You know, it's a military town. So we've got a little sprinkle of everybody from everywhere. I was super athletic, but I also, this is also the time when people played outside, so you knew your gauge against others. So I knew I was fast and all of that, and I played a lot of sports growing up. I have always been super inquisitive, very into school, kind of, but not like, I ain't do homework or nothing like that, but like I cared about learning and getting good grades and whatnot. And so my entire life, I actually wanted to be a doctor.
Okay.
My father talked me out of it. Once I got to college, he's kind of like, you don't want to be no doctor, girl. You want to be in finance. Mm-hmm. And so he thinks that he's the brain and that I'm Pinky and we'll take over the world. But, you know, he's got the master plan. Mm-hmm. And so from very young, he had me reading books, including like things like Plato's The Allegory of the Cave. I was like 9 years old. I didn't know what any of that meant. But starting down a path of like daily reading and being inquisitive, and he is a developer. So I was always in his office sending FedEx and faxes just to be able to go and have pizza and stuff like that. So
interesting. So you talked about the early influence that your father had. What else, if any at all, what are some of the other key experiences you can kind of think back to between mom and dad? Oh, yeah, mom and dad, when it comes to just exposing you to conversations around money and entrepreneurship and wealth that maybe you didn't realize at the time because you were so young, but looking back in retrospect, you're like, oh, okay, that's why I am the way I am now.
Yeah, so my mother is also an entrepreneur. She's owned a salon my entire life. So I grew up in that salon doing hair on mannequins and watching her work hard because she would get there early in the morning, stay until late at night. I also have, my grandmother was in the military, so that's how we got to that area. And she is a, I read every single thing, every contract. She understands the importance of advocating for yourself. I didn't realize how much that played a part of like who I became.
Right.
Because I'm really not afraid of anything because of her. And then my grandparents, who are my my dad's parents, have been entrepreneurs slash politicians my whole life. So I grew up going the summer to spend with them. I flew by myself. So I've always been, so since 3 years old with a tag, flying to Melbourne, Florida for them to take me to Vero Beach. And my grandfather was the chairman of the school board at the time and owned Orange Groves and a grocery store and a bunch of other businesses. And my grandmother ran a beauty salon and took care of the family. And so a lot of how I was shaped is it's family oriented, but, you know, self-sufficiency. And my grandfather always said from when I was really young, you know, you always got to pay yourself first. But pay yourself first means that you take the first 10% of your money that you earn and you invest it, because he's like, you don't want to wake up in 50 years thinking that all you did was pay bills. So you can figure out how to make the rest of that money stretch to bills. But you'll pay yourself first because you work for yourself. And then, you know, take what's left over and then do whatever fun thing that you're trying to do. So very early, talking about money as just a normal course, having good credit. I went into college as an authorized user on everybody's card. So I had 800 credit, which was terrible for a freshman in college, by the way. Although people, you think that they're doing service to their kids by doing this. What happens is with much is given, there's a lot more responsibility that we're not necessarily ready for. So I'm getting these $10,000 credit cards. I'm 18 years old. What I want to do, I want to go to the games. I want to be fresh. I got a Coogi sweater. You know what I mean? So I was really just becoming a really bad consumer debt holder at the time. And I am blessed. So my parents paid it off because they didn't have to pay for me to go to college. But but I learned quickly. So through bad things, you do learn the lesson and you're kind of like, yeah, I'm cool on that. So I've not had consumer debt since then.
Got you. Fast forwarding to college, where does track and field now come into the picture? Because that is a very interesting turn in all of this. How did that come about?
Yeah. So growing up, I was always fast. I raced down the street, pole to pole, all that. Gang gonna whoop me. And I was fast. So I would race people who were on bikes and all that kind of stuff. But I didn't run organized track until high school. So when I got to high school, I started at one school. I was in the band. And so I played the trombone and I was a cheerleader and I did all the things. And then I also wrestled my first year. And then I transferred to a school that was good at track. And so I had second semester of freshman year. And I was like, yeah, you know, I think I want to run track. So I go out, get whooped every day in every rep. So I'm like, I don't even, am I not fast? Like, what is going on? But what I learned in that process is that track had a bunch of events. So I'm telling my coach, like, I thought I was fast. I guess I ain't fast. Mm-hmm. So he's like, no, let's try hurdles. Let's try jumps and all that kind of stuff. So that's actually how I started doing hurdles, because this one girl named Erin Towns whooped me every day in every workout. And so when I made it to the Olympics, I literally shouted her out, because had you not been whooping me, I probably would have been a mediocre sprinter.
There you go. So you're in track now. And by the way, now I see how the name La La Hurdles came about, right? So
it was my AOL screen name, dial-up.
Hilarious. Now we're taking it back, y'all. So you're in school, you're competing in track, you ultimately get the opportunity to compete in the Olympics in 2012, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So when was the exact moment that you knew that you wanted to transition from being this world-class athlete to now starting to venture into law? Because I remember you said earlier your dad wanted you in finance, you're doing track. Obviously, now you're in the law space. Like, how do we now connect the dots there?
Yeah. So when I was an undergrad, I changed my major 7 times. I started off in biology pre-med, which is a blessing because you take classes that are transferable to any major.
Right.
By the end, I am a finance major. I have to take like 21 hours or something ridiculous to graduate on time. One of the classes that I take my senior year is business law. Hmm. And the professor has an MBA JD. He's like, I didn't have to give you a curve on this test, and I teach a Socratic method, which is how they teach law school. You should go to law school. And I'm kind of like, for what? Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm telling you, you should go to law school. That's him planting the seed. Mm-hmm. So I graduate with a finance degree, super focused that I'm going to be a hedge fund manager. Like, I'm not going to take the job with Goldman. I'm not going to do whatever. I'm going to run. So I get the opportunity to continue to run, and I'm going to go to grad school. Mm-hmm. So I decide that at first I say I'm going to get the MBA JD, but then I realize, like, all right, if you commit and you don't finish, you don't get either. So I'm going to separate them. So I started in business school first, and then I moved to Miami. I was training, got the MBA, and then I took the LSAT on a humbug because they told me that I didn't need to know anything. It's games and logic and that kind of stuff. It's not like the GMAT, which is what you take to go to graduate school where you need to know calculus to get a good score. So I'm like, cool, I just take it on a humbug. Like, sign up, take it. I get a good enough score to get into Florida and Florida A&M because I know that I'm moving to Orlando at this point to train in a new group in Claremont, Florida. So, and that's right in between the two. So I'm like, okay, cool. If I knew what I know now, I probably would have went to Florida, but it's just because of the grading curve system, which you don't know if you're not in law school.
Right.
So I end up deciding that I'm going to go to Florida A&M, which is 20 minutes shorter drive. Mm-hmm. That's literally the reason. And I go and I start in the fall of 2011. Mm-hmm. I leave after orientation to go to Korea for world championships for track and field. Mm-hmm. And then I come back, and that's my 1L year, first year. And then after that summer, I go to the Olympics. So I'm kind of a glutton for punishment because I'm literally just like going to practice, 9 a.m. to 2, class, 2 to 7, get a massage or chiropractor, go home, take a nap, wake up, do it all over again from 6 a.m. I'm probably going to go hot yoga or something. My life was kind of like trance at the time because I don't remember that much about it. I'm just like
going through the
motions. Doing the steps is required. I do go to the Olympics that summer. Mm-hmm. And great experience. Mm-hmm. Meet all the basketball players and all the things. And they're all thinking like, wow, you are crazy. Like, mm-hmm. how are you in law school and the Olympics? And I built relationships and started working with athletes because they became my friends. And I was like speaking about business in a way that they had never heard.
Yeah.
And I just started going to meetings with them. And like, that was the beginning of figuring out that I really wanted to work with high net worth individuals and helping them navigate the finance world, which was normal to me. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's it.
And here you are now.
That's right.
Come on. So you're titled as a because I'm learning this. I used to think like all law was unilateral and universal. If you're a lawyer, it's kind of, it's all in the same bucket. I've learned very quickly that that is not the case. Mm-hmm. You are in the category of being a, correct me if I'm wrong on this, a securities attorney. Mm-hmm. What exactly is a securities attorney?
Yeah, so securities are when a person owns a piece of a business, mm-hmm. And they don't work in the business. So it's got a 5-prong test, but the most important part is knowing that it's a person who doesn't work there, who is expecting a return, mm-hmm. On money that they've given. And so loosely, even when you buy a stock on an exchange, you're buying securities, you're trading securities. Mm. So what my focus has always been is securities offerings that are exempt from the SEC's registration. And that's just $100 million or less. and you're raising it from third parties, and it's debt or equity that you're raising. And
So, I mean, that's heavy because now it's, obviously it's safe to say that you're in a space now where you're working with individuals who are very wealthy, for lack of a better term. I'm curious to know, when you think about, if we go back to from your earliest experience of getting into the space up until now and thinking to some of the wealthiest individuals that you've worked with, what would you say has stood out to you most over that time period in regards to how they view money, how they approach money, how they handle their money that may be different or that most people may not know?
Depends on how they derive the wealth. Okay. So I do, like, 60% of my clients are athletes. Okay. And so the way that they look at money and the way that people who built businesses and sold businesses differs quite a bit.
Okay.
They both sort of have a level of discipline about it, mm-hmm. about the way that they operate their life. Mm-hmm. But I say for the day-to-day business person who becomes really wealthy, they look at money as a tool. They look at money as something that you use for opportunity, mm-hmm. and they are acting and taking risk in a way that, like, most people look at as too risky to move.
Yeah. Interesting. So how do you think that that now differs? Because I try and juxtapose everything. So how do you think that now differs from your experience in the way? Because I think most people, especially having individuals like yourself sit down here, what's great is most people are looking from the outside looking in. Mm-hmm. Especially in our community, a lot of the buzzwords we hear is generational wealth and financial literacy, passive income, all these different things. And most people who are having these conversations are speaking from the outside looking in. So they want to get there, but there's an information gap in regards to, okay, what does it actually take to become that? Mm-hmm. You're blessed by way of your hard work and the commitment that you've made to be on the inside looking out. So you kind of have perspective on both sides of the coin. So if we're talking more so to the business owners that you dealt with, how do you think that now differs from the way that most people in our community view money that may be keeping them from, if not getting to that level, at the very bare minimum, laying a foundation to where we can start to get closer and closer to that, not just having conversations about wealth, but actually creating a lifestyle for ourselves and for the people to come as well?
I'd say the biggest thing is doing more of what you do well. Just a lot more of what you do well.
Okay.
So what I see a lot in our community, when people are on their build, instead of like leaning into what they're doing well already, they're like, oh, I'm gonna start another business. Oh, seven strings of income, all that kind of stuff. Versus being like, okay, I do this really well. How can I build this business? How can I double this business this year? How can I build more strategic relationships and that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. That's probably the biggest difference, because doing more well and then learn, because most things in business is like you have an unfair advantage by having more information than someone else. Mm-hmm. And so if you do something long enough, you then realize the little quirky thing like, oh, I know where to get this for like 10 cents cheaper than somebody else. I know how to negotiate in a way because they don't know how I'm going to use it. So they think they're getting me and mm-hmm. I got a good deal because it's a good deal for me. Mm-hmm. But you only know that by having more information than other people. If you jump around, you have surface level information on all things. Mm-hmm. And when people use those like buzzy things like the riches and the niches, the truth is the more niche you are, the better you can speak to that person. So you just have way more of them coming to you to do business and stuff like that. And so that's what I'd say it's like focus, right? And the other thing is like talking and asking for help.
Okay.
So I really believe that asking for help is a superpower.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people are like, oh, I don't want people to know that I don't know. Or, oh, I don't want to seem like a novice or like I've just got here. But like if you literally just say, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? A person who's doing something well will help you. They'll say, oh, look at it like this. Or, oh, that's what you're doing. Oh, I got a person. I'm going to connect you. Yeah. Right? But the smaller entrepreneurs that I know don't talk to anybody. They sit in a room, in a silo, and they try to figure everything out by themselves instead of going to a conference, going to make friends that is in the industry, finding out who the best person is and bothering them until they help you, like all of that.
Right. I want to unpack that. Do you know who, a good friend of mine, do you know a gentleman by the name of George Achimpong?
Yes.
Okay. So he has a quote that I really love that I think speaks to a part of what you just said, where he says, wealth is built through concentration and then preserved through diversification. Kind of to the point that you just talked about where it's like, hey, oh, I see you nodding your head. Okay, we're going to unpack it. We're going to get into it.
All right.
But yeah, but essentially the essence from what I understand him to say is like, if you are trying to become wealthy, it doesn't start off first with, you know, we hear the term multiple streams of income. It doesn't start that way, right? You hyper-focus on one thing. And then once you have gotten your bearings under you or whatever that looks like for you, then at that point you can start to explore with diversification, right? I'm curious, you know, I kind of saw you bobbing your head there. So I'm not sure if that's something you agree with to where you're just like, no, it's straight concentration all the way through. Or maybe you do agree and you could speak to how do we as individuals know once we get to the point where we can start saying like, all right, I don't have to only hyper-focus on this. I can now start to poke my head in these different arenas. Where you stand when it comes to that?
Yeah, so I am hyper-focus, stay in your circle of competence person.
From now to the end of time.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But it's mainly because I watch people diversify their life on a normal basis. And what I said was diversify their life on a normal basis. And it's because you're a person, you're a real estate person, you're so bored, and you're like, you know, I do real estate well already. I'm going to go and invest over here.
Mm-hmm.
Minding these people's business.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know nothing about what these people are doing. So now you're like, oh yeah, you know, I'm invested in life science and they making cancer drugs and I put all this money and I'm super excited about it. Mind you, you don't know how to vet scientists.
Yep.
You don't know nothing about drugs. You don't know how to get to the market. You don't know how to get out the market. You don't know anything about the business. So it's so much easier for you to get finessed by the shiny suit man who is, you know, most charismatic salespeople, you know, on the other side of it, some of them are going to be legit. Most of them are not. They're going to be great salespeople who sell dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you can't tell the difference because you don't know enough.
Right.
And so when I say focus, it's more like, all right, my diversification is investing with others who do things I understand so I don't have to do all the work, but not necessarily investing in things that are so beyond my circle of competence that I'm now blindly following you into something that may work out, but just because something works out doesn't make it smart is what I follow on a normal basis.
Mm. Interesting. So what are your thoughts then? Because whenever I think about this topic, I immediately start thinking to like social media, right? Okay. And I kind of view social media in a way as almost like a double-edged sword. I think it's great in the standpoint of we're in a time now where information has never been more accessible than it is today to where people are able to get access to conversations like this from the comfort of their home. There's someone watching this right now, right? That lives in Colorado, Hawaii, wherever it may be, that is going to learn something that they can use to help change the trajectory of their lives and their family's lives. Never happened before. So that's great. To your point, I guess the flip side to that is you also have, for just as good as there may be, there's also some type of equal evil lingering somewhere there.
Right.
To where now in the same spaces where you're having healthy conversations like this, you may also have a lot of fluff and glitz and glamour that's pushed around to where you now have individuals that have a very warped and miseducated understanding about what it takes to actually play the game of money correctly. Where do you stand? How what are your thoughts when you think about the state of social media today and the role that it's playing in either helping or hurting our people get to have a deeper understanding of what it truly looks like to become financially literate?
Yeah. So my feeling about mass influence, right? Yeah. So social media allows anybody to say whatever they want to say, right? But I think that's, I think it's great because it sparks a lot of thoughts. So if you've never heard about non-performing notes, or you never heard about how art makes money, or you never heard about whiskey or real estate or whatever, sparks a thought. I think that we individually are not taking enough responsibility to do the second hand. Just look it up. Is this true? Is this not true? What are the nuances that goes with the thing? Because everybody's giving you a snippet, a snapshot, a little bit of information that helps sell something they're trying to sell you, blah, 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 right? So obviously I am semi-medium old. I grew up on encyclopedias, which was a point infinite information to us, right? Just like, how in the world are we writing papers with one book, right? That's crazy. And now we have unlimited information, but still don't look things up. So I think that the responsibility is not necessarily in the content creator to give you the best information. Most people need to take more personal accountability for, if you're going to make a decision or make a move, especially as it pertains to finances, how did you not ask Alexa? Ask Siri.
Ask ChatGPT. There you go.
Whatever. But I also look at, so ChatGPT is just like Google. Good in, good out, bad in, bad out. It hallucinates and all kinds of stuff. So you need to second check your source, all of that. But the bad, the worst thing that I see in the world is, for every good intentioned Aladdin, there's going to be a Jafar, right? And if you can't tell the difference, you have to take responsibility to advocate for yourself.
Yeah. Interesting. So I'm curious now, because you also said something also that I hung on to, where you talked about collaboration, and you essentially said that another key component that individuals may be missing when it comes to understanding how to truly play the game of money is getting to a point, whether whatever the term is for you, whether it's rich, wealth, whatever it may be, it's not about, I'm gonna lock myself in this dark room with this computer and work to my tail off, and that's how it's actually going to happen. It's going to happen by way of you, whether it's getting some form of a mentor, working with somebody who has the strengths that, you know, the weaknesses that you have and beyond. And it's interesting to hear you say that, because once again, from you being on the inside looking out, I know with your firm, and you can, I want to make sure I have the name right. It's like you run a multi-family office structure, almost like to where you work with multiple clients that have family offices, if I'm not mistaken. How consistent of a theme is that in a lot of the different, on the business side, not necessarily on the athlete side, but on the business side, is that something that you're seeing from a collaboration standpoint, where it's not just one person? Like, it on the front end, it may look like one person. Behind the scene, they got this accountant, this secretary, this assistant, this employee that's really helping them to come together in continuing to build themselves up and getting richer and wealthier.
Yeah, so I'm gonna give you an example.
Let's do it.
So if I'm looking at a person who wants to raise some money, so let's say they have a good business and they're looking to raise money based on, so when people raise money, it's generally on a strategy. It's not necessarily for that specific business. It's more like, I have a strategy that I'm doing. I might be buying businesses, I might be buying real estate, whatever the case may be. So it's not identified in advance. But when you look behind in the paperwork, it's one person that's in the front. And then they're going to say, okay, this is my leadership team. And that team may be internal people. It may be advisors. But they have a group of 3 to 5 people who they lean on for experience, sometimes for their balance sheet, sometimes for they have experience elsewhere that they're trying to coagulate that information. So, for example, one of the richest people that I ever met, his business was washers. You know what a washer is? It goes behind
talking
a screw.
About the little bolt joint.
It goes between the screw and the bolt that keeps it on.
So his business was that one little piece.
Yes. But So if you sold a regular washer in a hardware store, it sells for, let's say, 10 cents each, sort of thing. Well, he sells them on contracts to the FAA, because and they have to be replaced every 6 months. And so, first of all, you take that same washer, steel, whatever, cut into lots of pieces. It goes from being a 10-cent washer to $25 each. And you and they have to be replaced every 6 months. And this and that. Like, so that's an arbitrage of information.
Yeah.
Right? And so when I started thinking about business in that way, I'm like, oh, most people are doing the same things, but they meet a person from another industry and like, oh my gosh, I can do it like this, right? And so most board diversification or mentorship is, and advisors is not just being so linear, like, oh, I buy real estate, so I need six real estate guys. It's like, oh no, I need a person who thinks like this. I need this person. I need this person. And so everybody I know who is a top business person is surrounded by wisdom. And it could be of all kinds. Some of it is not just business people. It's people with jobs and giving perspective on how to get a contract with this company and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, I have always had a myriad of mentors, all of which would call me their friend, though. So they wouldn't think that they're my... I call them a mentor because they're older and I respect them and they're wise and all that. But, like, if apples come to apples, they calling me to drink. And we just having a good time and talking and all of that kind of stuff. And but if I called them to ask for advice, they just give it to me, you know.
What if the next time you heard from the banks, it was a $50,000 to $100,000 approval letter instead of another denial? You've been putting in the work, balancing your job, your business, and your family responsibilities. But here's the truth that most entrepreneurs never hear. Hard work alone is not enough to get the banks to say yes. Banks approve entrepreneurs who are structured the right way, and that's the missing piece that's been holding you back all along. We've seen it over and over again. Entrepreneurs who came to us who were stuck getting denial after denial got access to the right system, structure, and strategy that unlocked $50,000, $75,000, and even $100,000 credit approvals. And here's the real cost of waiting. Every month you go without having access to capital is another month where your opportunities are slipping into another business's hands. That's why we created the Fast Track to Capital, a free masterclass where we break down the exact steps needed to make yourself look fundable to banks so that you can access the capital needed to scale your business. We only do this training a limited amount of times per year, so if you're ready to secure your spot, click the link above or below this video so that you don't go another year without having the access to capital that your business needs.
I think another reason why these conversations are so important is because I like to challenge I love to challenge the belief, because I think a lot of people feel as though the getting, when we have conversations around just money and wealth, and let's even if we want to simplify getting rich, it seems like such this far-fetched thing for so many individuals, to where there are certain habits and practices that they can start implementing today that'll get them way closer to there than they ever were. But for them, once again, because it seems so far, they don't even start putting those things into practice. From your experience, if I'm somebody who's watching this conversation and wants to start thinking like the wealthy, or start putting myself in position to start playing in that game, are there certain practices, things that I can start putting in place, resources I can start tapping into to start heading in that direction?
Yeah. The number one thing is, how are you introducing yourself? Right? So when you meet a person, it doesn't matter what you do, actually. You need to have that, I call it like a little one-liner that makes people intrigued enough to ask you more questions. Because what most people do when they meet strangers is, oh, hi, my name is LaVon, and I'm a lawyer.
And that's it.
That's it.
Ain't nothing else.
Right?
Come on.
But, you know, when you realize that you are trying at all times, especially if you're new in business, not even new in business, like you're trying to build your business, every person is a potential partner, is a potential client, is a potential investor, is a potential whatever. So you need to be engaging in a way that makes them want to talk to you, ask you questions, and talk in general, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you were a person who was raising money, you'd say, you know, hi, my name is LaVon, and I help people make double-digit returns backed by real estate. They'd mm-hmm. say, well, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Versus, you know, I flip houses.
But once again, that's the vernacular that we're used to hearing online. So it's like, it sounds, for us, it sounds simple. It sounds sexy. That's because that's what mm-hmm. we're used to. But essentially you're saying from the rooms that you're being in, like, that's not really the way to get across with a lot of the individuals that you could potentially form a lot more fruitful relationships with.
Yeah. And just talk. Because at the end of the day, the first 20 clients I made after law school, moving back to Fort Lauderdale, first 20 clients, first 50 investors, strangers sitting next to me at a bar.
Mm.
And I'm just talking to them. And the easiest way to talk to a stranger at a bar is, hey, what you drinking, girl?
Mm-hmm.
What you drinking? Oh, this is what I'm having, blah, blah, blah. And being in what I used to think was negative, or, you know, I kind of got a Southern
mm-hmm. accent. A little twang, a little something,
you know.
Right.
It becomes a conversation, number one, because they'd be like, where are you from? Because first of all, people in most places
mm-hmm.
are not friendly.
Yeah.
So if you just start talking, even if they're having a bad day and don't want to talk, they'll start talking. And you'll get to learn things. The best way to have a conversation with people is to let them talk about themselves and not you talk about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because you'll also learn how you can help them in some way, because they're going to give you, most people is going to give it up.
Yeah.
Because they're not thinking they're going to build a relationship with you for the future. So,
right.
You know, there's absolutely there's nothing beyond today. So mm-hmm. they can tell you, this is what's going on, da 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 da, my job, mm-hmm. my wife, my kids, my this and that. And you could be like, oh, do you have an emergency kit?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm going to say to most people. And they're going to say, what does that mean? If something happened to you right now, does anybody know how to get in your bank accounts? Does anybody know anything about anything?
Mm-hmm.
And most people are going to say, no, I really haven't thought about it, you know, whatever. If they're not 80 or something, you know?
Right.
And for most people, having just that sparked conversation, I've turned them into a lead.
Right.
And generally, I'm going to be at the bar at the Four Seasons. So you're going to pick your locations
mm-hmm.
strategically enough that you know that you are got a high probability of reaching your actual target client, whoever that may be.
Mm-hmm.
And you set yourself at those bars. You set yourself at those events and build relationships.
One of the things I mentioned earlier, I want to quickly go back to it because I named it, but I know I want to make sure the audience knows what it is. So I don't want to just gloss past it without making sure the audience knows what it is. I said the term family office.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about, for those who don't know, what a family office is and how having an active hand in one yourself has helped to shape your approach when it comes to money and managing wealth and also investing?
Yeah. So we started off as a single family office, my family,
mm-hmm.
Because my grandfather's been a land hoarder forever, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But what a family office does is organize your family's affairs in a business-like manner.
Okay.
And so that you can handle and control things that most people outsource to others.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that has more control, but also more favorability for your standing. So, like, for example, it'll do all the work that you would have used an investment banker, an insurance person, a concierge person. And it will generally own active businesses. If the generation of your wealth was a business, that family office is going to also run those businesses. They're going to make sure that it has a CEO and the team and all
right.
that stuff and the right amount of money. But its real job is to take care of the nuclear family it's supposed to take care of. So in our case, there are 6 kids, 10 grandkids, 18 great-grandkids, you know, that are taken care of by this family office. Some of them work in the office. Some of them do not. And then what does that look like? What does governance look like? All of that is encompassed in this business-like affair that is dealing with everything that families need, from filing taxes to banking to insurance, all services.
So it's almost like an in-house financial arm, so where it's like, instead of me having to go outside and getting like a H&R Block to do my taxes and a Rocket lawyer, like I pretty much hire all these individuals in-house and they don't work with anyone else but me.
Yep.
Pretty much. How much money do you have to make before you even get to a point where you need a family office? Or can you start it as early as you would like?
So you can start it as early as you would like, but having staff costs money.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, right. So a lot of people start, so I start athletes generally with a family operating system.
Okay.
So it has entities, but almost all of the jobs are outsourced. But in a way that holds the vendors accountable to you in a different way than like if you just like, oh, I'm a Chase private client, you have a banker, but the banker has 1,000 clients.
Yeah.
And so they're going to answer your calls, but not in a way that like if you had a vendor that was in charge of making sure that you got the best banking products, right? Mm-hmm. And that's their only job. And you contract with them, you might pay them a little monthly retainer, but they're going to make sure if you need a loan to do something, you're going to get it and you're going to get it quickly. And they already have all your documents and that kind of stuff. So streamline. That's the lowest cost version. Mm-hmm. The highest cost version, I'd say multifamily office, that you sharing with other families, your staff. Most start around $30 million in investable assets. And single family offices, probably 50 to 100.
50 to 100.
Because we're talking staff, people who do due diligence on your investments internally, who go and source your internally. People that are going to know insurance products so well that they're going to go scorch earth to find you the best carriers and all that kind of stuff for your internal products and build products for you like PPLI, which is private placement life insurance, which allows your cash value to be invested in private equity and real estate and other things that like a regular insurance policy can't do. So these people cost money. So generally, a single family office staffing budget annually is around $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to have enough money to pay that and still make returns and, you know, still, you know, not eat into your principal. Because that's for me, the biggest goal is becoming wealthy enough that you never spend your principal again. You're only spending the money that the money is making.
Mm. Whenever I hear these conversations, another term I hear thrown around a lot, and I want to make sure I demystify for the audience, because I've heard it broken down in so many different ways, so maybe I can clarify to you, estate planning.
Okay.
So I hear about estate planning and like making sure that you have a trust in place so that if something happens to mom, something happens to dad, you're not in court fighting tooth and nail for property. How exactly does that work when we talk about protecting, whether it's the portfolio that we're building and the assets that we're acquiring, and what does that process actually look like?
Yeah, so estate planning can be as simple as make a will and decide that y'all are gonna go. So you can skip a good amount of the probate process by having a very clean will, one copy, never deviated and all of that. Mm-hmm. And it's contestable though, so it will go through probate. Or as complex as multiple trusts that are irrevocable, which means that the things have been removed from your estate during your life.
Okay.
It's its own entity. It can never die. It's over here minding its business. It owns assets.
Mm-hmm.
And then who's managing it and all of that. That's the complexity of it. But estate planning is literally planning how the things that you have acquired during your life are distributed during and after your life.
Right.
Yep, that's all estate planning really is. But like the modalities and functionalities within it are kind of infinite and depends on the assets you have and what you want to do and all that. Trusts are super mystified by lawyers a lot, but in real life it's just a contract.
Right.
And and who governs the contract you choose in the language.
Mm-hmm.
It is an entity type. So while it is like a revocable type, it's just you by another name. So it's used for privacy.
Mm-hmm.
But removing things from your estate has other implications. So a part of the planning in the people who really need estate plans early in life is when they know they're going to build something big. Mm. Because during your life, you have a giftable max, which means that during your life, right now, it's legislated, though, so it changes. Right. So right now, that number is $14,900,000.
Okay.
You can gift it out of your name during your life, right? So let's say you have a business, you've got some assets, you can gift them out of your name into this trust over here. They no longer belong to you.
Mm.
But every dollar above that number,
mm,
taxed 40%. So families who know they're building something big transfer early.
Yeah.
So that you don't, like, the Waltons have never paid taxes because they created a family partnership,
mm-hmm,
that separated all to the five, right? So everybody's got 20%. Even the kids were young at the time. The business is only worth a little bit of money. And the minor stuff is held in trust. Parents, they're voting, all the things.
Mm-hmm.
Company goes public,
mm-hmm,
right? Skyrockets. That $5,000 becomes billions of dollars.
Yeah.
But nothing is being realized. Realized means you sell something, you earn money. So if you don't work there, you don't earn money.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't take a distribution because you're an owner, nothing is going on. You just own the stock.
Mm-hmm.
You could take loans from the stock. Loans are not taxable. And as long as that's the case, because the transfer was done in advance, you've got billions of dollars that'll never be taxed.
Mm-hmm. Around the conversation of asset protection, I actually read an interesting stat coming into this interview where it said that 70% of wealthy families lose their fortune by the second generation, 90% lose it by the third. So obviously we know that trusts are used to kind of make sure that, hey, post me not being here, my family gets taken care of. Have you ever seen scenarios, though, where the next generation wasn't prepared and despite these things being put in place? And what are some of the lessons that I guess we can pull from those experiences, if any, if you have any at all?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is like preparing your children to have desire enough to want to earn.
Mm.
Because what happens in most cases is the father becomes wealthy. The mm-hmm family now lives a different life. They have kids.
Yeah.
The kids have never really wanted for anything. They've never had to work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so their level of thinking and how money is earned and all of that is skewed. So when things become hard, they don't want to do them, that kind of stuff. And then take a person who's lived a soft life,
mm-hmm,
and give them children. They live the softest life of history.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just an assumption that life is great. So the way that most people are protecting their children from this is not letting them become trustees, keeping them basically cushied.
Yeah.
So they live on what the assets are generating, and it's not necessarily making them better people per se. Eventually, they'll be the outliers who are just like self-motivated and that kind of stuff. But in general, the reason is just like disconnection from earning,
mm-hmm,
is a problem.
Yeah.
Because you're just like living on the fruits of someone else's work, and you become dependent on it, and you don't know how to like solve problems for yourself. So you don't have the confidence that you can,
mm-hmm,
because confidence comes from proving to yourself that you can do things, not like assuming you can do them, mm-hmm, in a hypothetical world.
Mm. Well, so then with that being the case, what are some conversations and practices that most individuals with children can start to put in play today to where it's like, I know that when my time comes, I'm not essentially handing the keys to the castle to someone that's never had to grit their teeth and really go through, because obviously it's very hard to mimic,
mm-hmm,
your
mm-hmm
life onto your children's life. But I'm sure there are things that we can do to where it's like, even though I may not be able to do that, I'm still going to do X, Y, and Z to prepare you for what's to come when my time comes. What does that look like?
Most of the people who I think have done a good job, like they're now elderly and their kids have taken over the business,
yeah,
and they're like doing, and they're all like good citizens.
Mm-hmm.
What I saw was they sort of didn't allow them to behave like they were rich. Like, we rich. You get to the back, right? You need to read. You have to do things. You have to earn your own money. You have to come up with a business plan. You have to be a productive part of this family in order to receive the benefits of the fruit of the labor. That's been the common denominator that I've seen of like, oh, wow, how'd you get all of your kids to become successful? And the difference, and it's like glaringly different too, where you're like, oh, wow, every one of your kids is doing something and not all of them end up in the business. It'll just be like, oh, that one's a doctor, that one's a lawyer, this person's a business person, or they're doing something else. But self-sufficient, living a good life, seems happy, you know, that kind of stuff.
For where you are in your personal individual journey with the work that you're doing right now with a lot of wealthy entrepreneurs that you work with, what would you say is the vision that you have for yourself and your firm over the course of the next 5 to 10 years? Like, why do you do what you do at this stage? Because you don't have to.
So having a baby actually changed me a lot, because I'm not super money motivated in general. So once I got to a point where I'm like, okay, the assets sort of pay for the lifestyle. If me and my dad get into an argument, I'm not coming to the office no more. Like that was just, it was a bad way of living, right? Not bad per se, but it's just different. Then you have a kid and you realize like my need for nothing is not the same level of need for nothing when you have somebody else who needs a good life and who needs to learn things and they need exposure and blah, blah, blah. So it costs a little more money than the like, I mean, I probably still could do it. It just wouldn't be as like, if I want lamb chops and lobsters, we have a lamb chops and lobsters type of a life, you know? And so now I have several goals. But one of them is I want to be able to put a lot of single mothers in the position to own their own home through a program that I created, which is we're buying notes and fixing the houses up and that kind of stuff. And then we're helping them getting to home buyer programs. So they'll learn the process and they'll learn about like what maintenance and all the things that come along with home ownership. And we'll seller finance them the house. And if they pay on time for 5 years, we'll forgive the note. So I am super passionate about single mothers since I became a mother, because I have a full-time nanny and a husband and other kids, and I'd be tired as hell. So I know a person with no help. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Like, how have y'all done this long? I want to give y'all things, you know? Because I realize that even though there are a lot of things, there are a lot of resources, but you don't have time to like think about it, to worry about it when you're like, I got a kid over here doing something, I got to go to work, I got 1,000 bill collectors calling me. It's just not enough time to think. So I really want to do something that can like help take some pressure off of their life and like, you know. So that's on the sort of philanthropic side. On the business side, my big audacious goal for 2025 was to do $1 billion in loan volume. And so we do business loans and real estate loans. And probably 80% of our loan volume for the last 12 years has been people of color. And so to me, that means if I'm doing that, I'm getting people the money they need to build their business, to build their portfolio in ways that they want. So that's why that is a goal. The other goal is I am just passionate about people being better CEOs of their own lives. And having the confidence to believe that they don't need a savior, a government, anything to like give them something that like, okay, here are the tools, here are the steps, and like, even though you may already be successful, that's when the vultures come. So this is how you protect yourself from vultures. This is how you do audits. This is how, you know, you hold people accountable. These are the questions you need to ask and like have more confidence in the fact that like, it doesn't make you less than to ask questions.
Right.
And so I'm super passionate about that. So that's why I still work and go hard and take a lot of clients, a lot more than I'm ever going to take ever again. This is probably the last year that I will be super involved with individual clients. But yeah.
So when you do get to the point of accomplishing these things from the philanthropic side with your passion project for single mothers and even everything you have going on the business side, if we look, if we look further on into the future, what would you hope that when people look back and have conversations around the work that you've done, what would you hope is the legacy that you leave behind?
That I left every place a little better than it was when I got there. Whether that's a community, whether it's a person, whatever the case may be, they're like, wow, talking to her lit my day up. Working with her improved my life, improved my business, something like that. That's all I ever strive for. And that's why I try to tell people that, like, helping has never been about money.
Yeah.
You can help people just by being the positive, the one positive voice to say, girl, you got it.
Yeah.
Don't worry about anybody, what anybody else has to say. Because there's enough negative people in the world, enough terrible energy that, like, just being positive is gonna help somebody.
Yeah.
You've seen people post their 50K approvals online, but have you ever wondered why it hasn't happened for you yet? You're clocking in at your 9 to 5, you're building your business after hours, you're even stacking your 401K and setting money aside for investments. So on paper, you're doing all the right things, but here's the problem. Growth feels slower than it should, opportunities keep passing you by because the capital isn't there, and you start wondering if building a real legacy for your family is even possible. It's not about effort or commitment because you've already proven that you have both. The missing piece is having the proper structure. That's why inside of our free masterclass, The Fast Track to Capital, I'm going to show you a step-by-step process on how entrepreneurs just like you are securing $50,000 to $100,000 in capital safely without wasting years on trial and error. So if you want to secure your seat, click the link above or below this video to save your spot and don't keep grinding without the structure that gets real results.
As we start to close, my last question for you. If you were sitting in my seat and sitting across from you was Lala 10 years into the future.
Okay.
And she only had 30 seconds to speak with you, speak to you. What do you think she would say?
Wait, am I saying something to my 10-year-old ago self?
No, not 10-year-old ago, 10 years into the future. So however old you are now, 10 years into the future, you're sitting in my seat. She's sitting across from you. She's speaking to you. You're not saying anything. She's speaking to you, but she only has 30 seconds to speak with you. What do you think she would say?
Thank you for protecting me. You know, because we all, you're doing everything that you think you should be doing, staying God-led, not being moved by money, and... you know, you're doing as good as you can with the resources you have. You've been a blessing.
Beautifully said. Lala, thank you for coming on the show. I know we got to get you out of here. Your camera right here. Of course, let the people know where they can find you and also let them know what you have going on.
Yeah. Okay. So you can find me at Lala Hurdles 2 on Instagram or on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active over there. What do I have going on? I have a book coming out.
There you go.
It's called The Hidden Wealth Code. I also have a community that I'm thinking about launching. You know, Alex Hormozi had me in my bag, so I had to, like, you know, I started a school community. It's called Velocity Alliance because I'm really trying to help people get where they're trying to go faster.
Yeah.
More resources, more money, more whatever, you know? And if you want to, like, book a consultation or something, b3xwiser.com, that's where the business is done. This will be my last year doing that, though. So book me while I'm bookable. And what I will say as my takeaway is, the person who thinks they're great is right. The person who thinks they suck is right. So be the person who speaks positivity into your own life, into the lives of others.
Boom. Appreciate you. But more importantly, ladies and gentlemen, and I appreciate each and every single one of you guys. If you haven't already, what are you doing? Take a second, take a minute, take an hour out of your day right here, right now to go ahead, hit that like button, show this episode some love, tell a friend to tell a friend to come back and rewatch the episode again. And as always, my name is Marvin Francois. That is the always incredible Miss Lala Idolette. You guys have been good. We've been great. This has been amazing. Thank you all. And until next time, peace, family.